so the House members should know as well, because part of what the Ethics Committee does is let other members know what the standards are and what lines should not be crossed, and I think the report helps to do that here as well.
So this was an Ethics Committee report. We were speaking just a moment ago about this DOJ investigation around possible criminal actions there. Is there anything that you have seen in this report that justifies any sort of legal action against Gates, say in Florida or on the federal level?
I'll have to defer to, you know, whether it's a civil action or, you know, state prosecutors, federal prosecutors. I'll defer to them to, you know, draw their own conclusions. But that's another reason it made sense to release this report publicly. Now, whoever wants to investigate this further or, you know, pursue other litigation in court, they can do that using the information that's out there now.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll all be following this story because the former congressman has also floated the idea of running possibly for a Senate seat. Congressman Glenn Ivey, a Democrat of Maryland, thanks so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
On January 1st, millions of additional workers would have been eligible to earn overtime pay under a new rule issued by the federal government. But last month, that rule was struck down in court. And while an appeal is pending, those millions of workers are back to where they started, not making any extra money. NPR's Andrew Hsu has been talking to some disappointed workers and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first, can you just explain this rule to us? What was it supposed to do?
Yeah, so federal law requires that if you work more than 40 hours a week, your employer has to pay you time and a half. Now, there are some exceptions to this rule, and a big one is that if you're a manager or you have a role where you have significant decision-making responsibilities, you're not eligible to earn overtime unless your salary falls under a certain threshold. And the Biden administration felt that threshold, which was about $35,500 a year, was way too low. So through this rule, they were going to raise it to closer to $59,000 a year.
That's a big jump.
Yeah, it is. And I talked to workers who would have benefited from this, including a woman named Dalila. Now, she asked us not to use her last name because she's worried about getting in trouble with her employer. But Dalila works for a school district as a family liaison. Parents call her if their kids need help at school, like if their kid is being bullied, or sometimes they call her if they need help with something outside of school.
I need insurance. You know where I can get medical insurance. My children get the immunizations. Where can I take them?
You can imagine, Esma, that these calls come in at all kinds of hours in the evenings and on the weekends. And at busy times of the school year, Dalila says she easily works 50 hours a week or more. So had this overtime rule kicked in, she could have been making hundreds more dollars per week, which she was really excited about.
Yeah, I imagine she would have been really excited, and a lot of workers would have been. But I also imagine that employers, at least some of them, were perhaps less excited about this.
Yeah, employers large and small were really worried. They submitted thousands of comments to the Labor Department saying, you know, this rule would lead to all kinds of harm for them, for their workers, who they said would lose opportunities, and for the economy. But employers did have another choice. Rather than pay people time and a half, they could give employees earning under that new threshold a raise.
Huh. So even under this new rule, you're saying employers still would not have been obligated to pay all workers overtime?
Well, yeah, if they raised their salaries to above the new threshold of, you know, close to 59,000, they would still be exempt from the rule. So this is what happened with some 300 employees at The Ohio State University, people who work all over the school, including the athletics department and at the medical center. The school actually gave them raises on November 1st to comply with the rule. But then 2 weeks later came that court ruling in Texas. The rule was struck down. And a week after that, Human Resources sent out an email telling those Ohio State employees that their raises were being rescinded in the new year. They get to keep the increases for 2 months, and then they would go back to what they were making.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah. Now, Ohio State's position is they have 50,000 employees, and they want to make decisions taking the whole institution in mind. But that said, the school told me that these raises would have cost them a little over $2 million a year. So that's not a whole lot of money for a school with a $10 billion budget. And I did speak to one person who's about to lose their raise, who didn't want their name used because they fear retaliation from the school. They said it was a punch in the gut. It felt like the school didn't value their work.
All right. NPR's Andrea Hsu, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Asma.
December can be a magical time of year. But after losing a loved one, it can also feel bittersweet. It can be especially hard facing that first holiday without a spouse. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
I've been taking a different route home this month to avoid a Christmas tree lot in the back of Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral. For years, it's where my husband and I would go back and forth over the perfect tree. One year, he joked that he wanted to stuff the Douglas fir in the back seat of the car and tie me to the roof. We won't have that fight this year because he died in February. I've been dreading this time of year for months. Facing the holidays alone in my house will be new to me, but I know I'm not the only one. So I reached out to our listeners and asked them to share their stories. Sophia Dembling from Dallas, Texas, lost her husband Tom in 2020 after 28 years of marriage.
Last Christmas was my first one at home, and it was very difficult for me. It was hard waking up Christmas morning with nobody here, and childish as it sounds, nothing under the tree for me.
For others, sharp reminders are everywhere, from holiday stockings to the empty chair in the living room where their loved ones used to sit. Ken Wash from Annapolis, Maryland, is facing his first Christmas without his wife, Leslie, who died this year from brain cancer. He says to call life without her hard is an understatement.
The house is empty. The house is very quiet. Nobody cares if I play music at 3 o'clock in the morning or eat a bag of marshmallows for dinner. That has to be kind of sad.
Don Villar lives in Chicago and lost his wife, Rose, earlier this year. He says while it's been difficult this holiday season, he's trying to find solace in the memories they shared.
It's tough, but, you know, the memories, actually, it's the memories that put a smile on my face. And while the sorrow was always there, just having that memory of that what we did here, you know, it sort of brings her back to life.
Holidays without your loved ones can almost feel like you're an outsider looking in.
You walk into a store and you hear holiday music and you hear a song that reminds you of the person you're missing, and everyone else looks like they're just fine.
That's Lori Gottlieb, a psychotherapist and author based in Los Angeles.
But the reality is, if you pick people out of that crowd, there's a good percentage of them who are going through something similar to what you are.
Talking to someone who's grieving during the holidays can also be hard. Instead of saying things like, they're in a better place now, or you'll get through this, Gottlieb says, focus on being empathetic, or just listen.
I don't know what to say, but I'm thinking about you, and I love you, and I care about you. How can I help? So many times people try to cheer the other person up or distract them. They say so many things that leave the person reeling.
For me, this holiday season is about trying to counter the sadness with the memories of the good times that I had with my husband. I worked all 14 Christmas days since we were married. This Christmas, I won't be getting the text message that he sent me 14 times. The one that read, hurry up and finish doing the news so we can open presents. Triple heart emoji. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
And thank you so much to Windsor for sharing that emotional story with all of us. Windsor's husband, who died earlier this year, was the former and first host of our show, Morning Edition, Bob Edwards. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19 on this Tuesday, Christmas Eve. That's an especially important story, I think, for a lot of people across Wisconsin right now. We have a lot more to get to this hour on the program, including news, which is coming up about 11 minutes from now. We'll also switch gears in just a couple of minutes, and we'll hear a story that comes to us from America's Test Kitchen about the secret to making the best mashed potatoes for the holidays. That's ahead on WPR.
Celebrate traditions old and new this holiday season with special programs all this month. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. Find beautiful music, friendly conversation, and engaging entertainment to keep you company at home, at work, and on the go. Explore the full schedule of seasonal programs at WPR.org/holidays. And thanks for listening.
Support for WPR's Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship is provided in part by a gift from Frank L. and Mary E. Nicolay. The Mike Simonson Investigative Reporting Fellowship helps WPR provide in-depth news coverage throughout Wisconsin.
Support for WGTD comes from the Lake Geneva Symphony, celebrating their upcoming gala, Putting on the Glitz, at the Abbey Resort in Fontana on Saturday, February 8th. More information and tickets are available online at lakegenevaorchestra.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, mostly cloudy across the state today, but no rain or snow in the forecast, so traveling for the holidays should be better today with highs in the 20s and 30s. Mostly cloudy overnight with some patchy fog, lows down into the teens and 20s. Tomorrow, much like today, pretty calm across the state, cloudy, and highs in the 20s and 30s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialist, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm A. Martinez. A holiday meal without mashed potatoes is kind of like Santa Claus without a beard. It's obvious something's missing. Mashed potatoes can be tricky. It's way too easy to make them too dry or too runny. Luckily, a Top Chef slid down my fake chimney to rescue my mashed potatoes from me.
So potatoes in general are a beloved vegetable.
That is Dan Souza, Chief Content Officer for America's Test Kitchen.
And on a holiday table, mashed potatoes play so well with all the other dishes on there. Let's say you have a roast or turkey along with some mashed potatoes. It just brings it all together. Add some gravy to that, and I mean, come on, you're singing at that point.
We don't care what they look like, we'll eat them any way they can fit on our plate. Every way we can conjure to eat them. We're delighted and think they're just great. Potato, 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 potato.
Dan watched over Zoom while teaching me a mashed potato recipe that mashes all the rules.
We're going to do some really different things today. And with mashed potatoes, there is one kind of cardinal rule. And that is that you take chunks of potato, you put them in cold water, and then you bring that up to a boil. We are going to break that rule today. And what we're going to actually do is we're going to start with boiling water and thinly sliced potatoes. And that is going to take about 12 minutes. 12 minutes to cook potatoes for mashed potatoes is lightning fast. If you had chunks in cold water and you were bringing it up, you're looking at, you know, an average of 40 minutes probably to get there. So that's the real beauty of this technique.
I put a pot of water on the stove, and while we waited for it to boil, I peeled some potatoes.
We love Yukon Golds or russets for this recipe. Yukon Golds are a little bit earthier and sweeter. Russets are the classic mashed potato. They have a drier texture. Both are great. I think we're going to go with Yukon Golds today because they have that nice butteriness to them.
All right, I'll start peeling them. Keep my fingers tucked in.
Yep, it's a good idea always to keep your fingers and palm kind of gripping the base of it. And then I like to keep my thumb on the potato itself so that you can easily make your way around it.
This feels like when I was a junior college baseball pitcher and I was feeling around to throw a curveball. Feels like my fingers are finding the seams of the baseball, of the potato in this case.
I love that. That makes sense.
Okay, I think I got this one adequately peeled. So now what?
All right, so once all the potatoes are peeled, we're going to slice them a quarter inch thick, kind of across the potato, the way like if the potato were a small loaf of bread, you'd go from one end to the other. Yep, those look great. Those are beautiful quarter inch slices.
All right, all sliced up, ready to go. Now what's the next step?
So now the water has come to a boil. We're simply going to add the potatoes to the pot, make sure it comes back to a boil, and then adjust the heat to maintain a very gentle simmer.
All right, potatoes in the pot with the water.
Whether you're banging dents out of your fender or mashing potatoes for Christmas, you gotta have the right tool for the job. So Dan luckily sent me a bunch.
So you have three different tools for making mashed potatoes in front of you. One is an actual potato masher. The base of it is a plate with perforations in it. Next up, you have a potato ricer, and it looks a little bit like a lemon squeezer. Now you can see that the holes on that basket are smaller than the potato masher, so the mash that comes out is much finer. The next one you have is a food mill. Now this is a way to make a really smooth puree. Do you want a coarser mash going with a potato masher? Do you want something a little finer with a ricer? Or you want something incredibly smooth with a food mill?
For deciding on which one of these three gadgets to use, do you need to factor in the ability of the chef? In this case, me, Dan.
No. So, you know, I think they're all really easy to use. Obviously, a potato masher is going to be probably the easiest.
Now, let's keep it simple here at the house. Dancing in the kitchen, straight to kissing on the couch. Let's keep it simple.
So, Dan, my wife left the room, but I've been meaning to ask you this because, okay, you know, I've told you before, she's a little bit maybe a cut above the average home chef. So let's just say, you know, I want to splurge on my home chef.
There are two categories of splurge. I have what I call a practical splurge, which is, you know, it's a big ticket item, but it's not absolutely astronomical. And it's something that they're just going to use on a super regular basis. And for me, that is a 12-inch stainless steel skillet with a layer of aluminum sandwiched between two layers of stainless steel. The aluminum transfers heat really, really quickly. So you get a responsive pan. It's probably about, you know, a little over $100. Now, if you really want to splurge, indoor high-end pizza oven.
Ooh.
It's a little under $1,000. But again, this is like the splurgy splurge stuff.
This potato tastes so good when I'm with you. Mashed potato, sweet potato, doesn't matter, it's true. Some fries to go so we can see the world. Me and my potato girl.
Now it is time to finally mash. You are choosing the potato masher, which I totally respect. The more you do it, the smoother they're going to get. The less you do it, the coarser texture you'll have.
All right, I'm going to be like the Incredible Hulk and start mashing.
All right.
Ooh, it's getting there pretty quick, actually.
Nice. That looks really good to me. Yeah, they look beautiful. We're going to stir in a half a cup of half and half, 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter, and finally a teaspoon of table salt.
I got to say, Dad, I'm kind of happy with these mashed potatoes. They actually look presentable.
They look amazing. I'm jealous that I'm not eating them, too.
I'd actually be very proud to serve this to my family, Dan. Wow. Tastes really good. Even I got a thumbs up from Mrs. A. Dan, thank you. This is great. If we do this for another 20, 30 years, I think I'll be a great chef at that point. You got 30 years in you, Dan, to visit my kitchen?
If you're willing to cook more, I always got more time for you, A.
Nice. Dan, thank you so much.
You're welcome, A.
That's Dan Souza, America's Test Kitchen.
Let's go, boys. Potatoes in the paddy wagon. Guess we better leave her there. Let's go, boys. Potatoes in the paddy wagon. Mama says it's more than fair.
This is NPR News.
Facing a manpower shortage in its war with Russia, Ukraine is increasingly relying on unmanned drones.
A bomb is dropping, you can see it falling, a large explosion now.
We're doing this every day, nonstop, 24 hours.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We go inside a secret command post in eastern Ukraine where drone pilots are trying to slow Russia's advance on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for being here on this Tuesday for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Hundreds of flight delays are being reported at airports across the U.S. this morning on one of the busiest travel days of the year. Wintry weather is occurring in parts of the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast, as well as the mountains of the Pacific Northwest. In addition, the FAA says a technical issue prompted a ground stop of all American Airlines flights for about an hour today. They've since resumed operations. The leaders of Mexico, Panama, and Colombia are objecting to some of the comments made by President-elect Donald Trump in recent days and weeks. Here's NPR's Ada Peralta.
President-elect Trump caused a diplomatic ruckus when he said the U.S. wanted to take over the Panama Canal once more, and then he said he would consider Mexican drug cartels terrorists. The president of Panama, José Raúl Mulino, responded with an address to the nation.
Cada metro cuadrado del canal de Panamá.
Every square meter of the canal belongs to us, he said. The president of neighboring Colombia, Gustavo Petro, said they would not hesitate to stand by Panama until, quote, the last consequence. Mexico, for its part, worries that if the U.S. designates drug cartels terrorists, it may open the door to military intervention. President Claudia Sheinbaum said they will collaborate and coordinate with the U.S., but, quote, they will never be subservient. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. It's still illegal to shoot fish with a gun in Wisconsin, but anglers will no longer face potential fines for carrying firearms. That's because a state legislative committee has repealed a 25-year-old DNR rule prohibiting people from carrying guns while fishing. An attorney for the DNR told the committee that the regulation dates back to the 1950s as a way to prevent anglers from shooting fish. Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty attorney Skyler Croy told the committee that the regulation is unconstitutional.
Because approximately 15% of Wisconsin is covered by water, the rule applies to a wide swath of locations. The rule never should have been promulgated. DNR has now conceded the rule is inconsistent with state law. We applaud the DNR for doing the right thing.
The gun ban repeal was requested by the DNR to settle a lawsuit filed by the firm in July. A woman in Jackson County has been arrested and charged with robbing two banks 6 years ago. The Jackson County Sheriff's Office says 26-year-old Michaela Davis was brought into custody after new information sparked the years-old investigation. Two banks in Jackson County were robbed near the same time, one in November of 2018 and the other in January of 2019. WEAU reports that police recently noticed a vehicle that looked similar to the one the suspect was seen getting into at one of the crime scenes, and that vehicle was registered to Davis. Davis reportedly admitted to robbing the banks and was brought into custody last week. The Green Bay Area Public School District violated federal Title IX rules in back-to-back school years. The school district entered into an agreement with the U.S. Department of Education to address concerns regarding its responses to sexual harassment. The Green Bay School District violated Title IX in the 2018-19 school year and the 2019-2020 school year. Federal officials say the district consistently failed to complete Title IX investigations into reported sexual misconduct. That includes instances when law enforcement was already investigating. In a statement, the school district says the Title IX violations were a, quote, paperwork technicality. The district's agreement with federal authorities includes commitments to ensure that policies comply with Title IX moving forward. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Churchill Downs, presenting the 151st Kentucky Derby, dedicated to creating unforgettable memories for more than 150 years. The Kentucky Derby on Saturday, May 3rd. Learn more at KentuckyDerby.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. As President-elect Donald Trump prepares to return to the White House, we want to talk about what a second Trump term could mean for countries and regions around the globe. Today, let's turn to Africa and for a look at how the U.S.-Africa relationship might shift in a second Trump administration, I'm joined now by two experts, Zainab Usman, she's director of the Africa program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Mvemba Pezo-Dizolele, he's director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you both for being here.
Very nice to be here.
Thank you very much, Asma.
What are the reactions that you've been hearing from Africans across the continent? How are they responding to the incoming Trump administration? And Zainab, why don't we start with you?
I think to begin with, many people are not that surprised to see President Donald Trump reelected. Even in his first term, people had very mixed reactions to him. There were those who kind of connected with his approach to being what they at least would describe as being a deal maker, as someone who communicated what he wanted and what he expected in return. There are a lot of African leaders and perhaps African stakeholders who can connect with that. I suppose they are, in a sense, expecting him and his administration to be a lot more focused on that deal-making approach.
What have you been hearing, Mvemba?
President Trump has a base in Africa, and that base is one that shares the religious views of many of the Republican parties and the support of Donald Trump. So they've seen him as this person who stands on the right side of culture wars, issues of gay rights, issues of abortions, and so on. So if you take a country like Uganda, that has been in a very turbulent relation with the United States and even with the World Bank over gay rights and so on, they welcome the return of President Trump because this will no longer be the issues that will be determined the quality and the nature of the relationship.
If we can talk about economic policy for a moment here, Trump has said that tariffs are the most beautiful word in the dictionary. Tariffs are broadly one of his signature economic foreign policy tools. He has threatened tariffs against China as well as regional trading partners like Canada and Mexico. What are any of the trade concerns in Africa, and are there concerns about tariffs or trade relationships?
Indeed, the African continent has a trade preference program with the United States called the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which allows a number of African countries, mostly outside North Africa, to be able to export duty-free to the U.S. market about 1,800 product lines. This trade program is set to expire in 2025, I think September or so. But I would say that also beyond AGOA, a key frame through which the U.S. has thought of engaging with Africa economically is the great power competition with China. And I think that is going to really motivate even the incoming administration of President Donald Trump, whether that means that there might be some strategic thinking around exempting African countries from these tariffs is yet to be seen.
But China is a key player in Africa, and the U.S. doesn't come as close as China in terms of investment and infrastructure project and the level of money that China is put into Africa. So as the president and his administration seek to counteract China in Africa, will they offer more opportunity to the Africans, or will they simply punish Africans for collaborating with China?
When we talk about investments, just earlier this month, President Biden visited Angola and pledged an additional $600 million to this large infrastructure project. Do you both see investments in Africa like this as bipartisan? And do you see, you know, this project that we're talking about in particular as having longevity beyond the Biden administration?
The Lobito Corridor project is meant to be a counter to China's Belt and Road Initiative. And I believe that there is actually bipartisan support around it. And the core of the project is actually a rail line that connects Zambia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola, and terminates at the port of Lobito in Angola, and is meant to transport unprocessed critical minerals, cobalt in particular, nickel, copper, and a few others. There are a lot of African stakeholders that are also worried that this looks like an extractive project. and they want to see investments in refining, value addition, and manufacturing and processing of these commodities rather than an extractive project.
There's a lot of incentive for the US Congress, particularly on the Republican side, to invest more in it because it signals action against China. The problem is on the ground, the Chinese have a strong grip on mining operations in Zambia and in the DRC. So unless the US is determined to increase its level of investment in the mining sector and literally do more than the Chinese are doing, it only will make sense if the US and China find a way to work together.
The US is the largest humanitarian donor to Africa in the world. At the same time, we've often heard the president-elect talk about the fact that America first is his central thesis. Are there concerns that aid priorities might change with this new administration?
Asma, for sure. Humanitarian aid has been important in Africa, and it is true that the US has been the leader in that space. But I hope that as the president takes charge, it will be clear to them that America first will not just depend on cutting aid here and there, but the very survival of the US is also connected to the rest of the world. It becomes important for the US to continue engaging, not just on the humanitarian side, but also on good governance and democratization, public health programs. There's just no way for the US to retract fully. It's just not going to be practically possible.
At the same time, if you really drill down into the numbers, something in the region of 50 to 70% of those disbursed funds actually end up staying in Washington, D.C. Very little gets to actual recipients. The amount of money that gets to actual recipients does help, but the problem is there's just a lot that is wrong with this entire system. When you talk to a lot of recipient countries, at least those that are not in war or in conflict, they would tell you that what they want is not humanitarian assistance, it's not charity. They want to be able to do better trade for their small businesses, for their local farmers. So I think there is some kind of reform that does need to happen.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having us, Asma.
Thank you very much for having us, Asma.
That was Zainab Usman with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Mvimba Pezo Dizolele with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:42 on this Christmas Eve Tuesday. Thanks for being with us. There's still a few more stories to get to this hour, and of course, news is coming up at 9 o'clock as well. Have you ever re-gifted anything, gotten an item, realized you weren't going to use it, gave it off to somebody else? We'll hear a story about that coming up in just a few minutes. Plus news, like I said, that's about 18 minutes away on WPR.
Imagine a year without Christmas. No hurried shopping, no holiday cards, no unwanted presents. That is exactly what Luther and Nora Crank have in mind when they decide that just this once, they'll skip the holiday and take a cruise instead. But as this weary couple is about to discover, skipping Christmas isn't as easy as they'd imagined. Join us for Skipping Christmas tonight at 9:30 on Chapter a Day.
Support for WPR comes from the Conscious Carnivore and the Fall Art Tour. Join the team of organizations that support a wide variety of informative and inspiring programs for the people of Wisconsin. More at WPR.org/sponsor.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Kenosha County United Way is seeking volunteers to staff their tax assistance program from February 1st to April 15th. For more information, visit KenoshaUnitedWay.org and click volunteer.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44. Here's what's happening in news. Israel says it's intercepted a missile which was launched at the country from Yemen. Israel's military says the projectile was intercepted before crossing into Israeli territory, but it still set off air raid sirens overnight in the country's most populous central area. The House Ethics Committee has released its report on former Congressman Matt Gaetz, detailing allegations of drug use and even allegations that he had sex with an underage girl. Aaron West was laid to rest yesterday. The 42-year-old was killed when a student opened fire at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison. 14-year-old Ruby Vergara was also killed in the shooting. She was laid to rest on Saturday. More news at WPR.org. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm Asma Khalid. When it comes to re-gifting, everybody does it from time to time. Come on, admit it, you've done it too. To prove that we are not alone, we asked Morning Edition listeners to share an embarrassing tale of re-gifting and getting caught.
My name is Robert Tognoli from Port Townsend, Washington. One year during our annual holiday party at work, I received a set of champagne glasses at our Secret Santa gift exchange. I rewrap the gift and give it to my niece on Christmas Day. When my niece unwrapped the gift, she exclaimed, "Thank you for the beautiful glassware, Uncle Bob, but who is Ruby?" My coworker Ruby had left a card that read "Merry Christmas" from Ruby inside her donated gift. Needless to say, that was my one and only attempt at regifting.
My name's Melissa Fosberg. I live in Washington, D.C. My nephew got married the year after we did. I reached into the wedding gift closet we had in our apartment and wrapped up this really nice pasta pot. We got home from the wedding and there was a message on our answering machine. "Hey, Melissa and Ian, this is Marianne. I just wanted to find out how you like the pasta pot I got you for your wedding." I forgot to open the box and look inside to see that her card was there. I'm so busted.
My name is Tiana Clevenger. This regifting story actually involves my mom. So the story starts when my godmother invited her over for a play date with her grandson. And being my mom, naturally she felt a burning need to bring a gift along. So she decided to take a book from the kids' playroom. My godmother takes one look at the title of the book and starts to laugh. And the title of the book is "I'm a Masonosaurus." It's one of those personalized ones where the main character, Mason, just happens to look exactly like my son. So you could almost hear the record scratch in the room. And my mom, meanwhile, stood there utterly baffled as everyone else burst out laughing.
I'm Cliff Knoll from Shutesbury, Massachusetts. For my dad's 70th birthday, I sent him a silver cross pen and pencil set engraved in gold with his initials. A year and a half later, a day after Christmas, my ex-wife called. My parents had sent her a gift, a cross pen and pencil set beautifully engraved, but not with her initials. I told her that I had an idea of what had happened. I went out and bought a clean cross pen and pencil set and gave it to her in exchange for the one she'd received. It then sat in my desk drawer for months until it occurred to me that one of my brothers had the same initials as my dad, and I sent the engraved set to him for his birthday. This may be a record of sorts. What we have here is a regift of a regift, accomplished via a corrective gift for regift swap, resulting in not one, but three happy giftees in the end.
Tales of regifting, embarrassment, and even redemption from NPR listeners. You're listening to NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, and thanks for being with us. It's 8:49 now on this Tuesday. Of course, it is Christmas Eve. Happy holidays to you if you're celebrating. There's still a couple more stories to get to this hour before news, which is coming up at 9 o'clock. We'll hear a story that comes to us out of Washington State, where Jay Inslee, the governor there, says that there needs to be a new wealth tax on the rich. That's just ahead.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Green Bay Packers have clinched a playoff berth by beating the New Orleans Saints 34-0 last night, moving to 11-4 on the year. The Packers are taking on the Minnesota Vikings this upcoming weekend, then they'll wrap up the regular season with a game against the Chicago Bears. In basketball, the Milwaukee Bucks got a win last night over the Chicago Bulls, 112-91, the final score there. The Bucks are back at home on Thursday night for a game against the Brooklyn Nets. That one is set to start right around 7 o'clock. In weather, it'll be pretty cloudy across the state today. However, no snow or rain expected, with high temperatures in the 20s and 30s. Overnight, low temperatures getting down into the teens and 20s. Mostly cloudy still with some patchy fog. Tomorrow, still no snow with high temperatures in the 20s and 30s once again. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. As some states look to cut income taxes, there's another movement afoot in Washington state to raise taxes on the wealthy. Jeannie Lindsay from member station KUOW in Seattle has more.
Democrat Jay Inslee has been the governor of Washington state since 2012. Now, as he prepares to leave office, he's making one final push for lawmakers to do what a handful of states are trying, a wealth tax.
This wealth tax would put a modest 1% tax on the wealth of residents that exceeds $100 million. So this tax would only be on the excess over $100 million.
Inslee's office says it could help cover an expected budget shortfall, more than $10 billion over 4 years, for things like housing and education. Calls for the wealth tax have fizzled out before, but proponents say it has a chance now, after voters backed the current capital gains tax on a ballot initiative this November. Inslee also says his wealth tax would make the system more equitable in a state without an income tax. Revenue mainly comes from sales, business, and property taxes.
Because our tax system has been very unfair to working people for 130 years.
And Washington is home to wealthy tech executives and former CEOs, including Bill Gates. Other states have considered more taxes on the wealthy, and Massachusetts voters approved a new tax on income over $1 million a year. But more than two dozen states have been going the other way, pushing to cut income taxes over the last few years. And critics of Inslee's proposal say Washington is already taxing people and spending too much.
I just think discussions of generating additional revenue for the state are premature until we start taking a really good look at the spending side of the equation.
That's Senator Chris Gildon, the top Republican on the state Senate's budget committee. He worries the proposal won't bring in as much money as the governor hopes and could drive wealthy job creators out of the state.
They're not tied here. They're not stuck here. They can leave anytime that they want.
There's a new governor replacing Inslee in mid-January. State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. He's also a Democrat, but Ferguson has said he wants to tighten up spending before considering new taxes. And he'll be the one with the final say over how the state balances its budget, though Inslee has joked he hopes the new governor still takes his calls. For NPR News, I'm Jeannie Lindsay in Olympia, Washington.
I've got a question for you all. Is ignorance actually bliss? Well, we're going to try to figure that out in the next few minutes. A new book by Columbia University professor Mark Lilla breaks down the constant and very human struggle between wanting to know things while also rejecting truths that might challenge us. The book is called Ignorance and Bliss on Wanting Not to Know. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So I've got to ask at the outset here, because I'm in the news business, and there feels like there is such a desire these days for people to just tune out the news. You know, people say it stresses them out. They don't have time for it. Are these non-news consumers onto something?
They are. There are all sorts of reasons, for example, to limit your flow of information. And so it certainly can be a good thing to sort of decide who's trustworthy and who's not trustworthy, and sometimes just to step back and reorder your thoughts and priorities.
You write in your book that some people are naturally curious and seek information, and some people have little to no desire to ask questions. Are we all prone to both dispositions?
I think we are. We've all met people like this, someone who can't let their curiosity go. And then there are people who either rightly or wrongly make the judgment that being curious all the time doesn't help their lives. It just sort of distracts them, and that they'll only pay attention when they think it's important. And so they don't treat curiosity as if it's some overriding human virtue. And then there's a third type of person who has a different disposition, and at times all of us have this temporarily. And that is, we just want to shut the windows.
So there's the personal aspect of not wanting to know, and then there's society at large. What causes a surge in large groups of people not wanting to engage with information, not wanting to engage with facts?
So when there are large social changes, you can understand that people might just want to stay in place while these things come at them until they figure out what is going on. But what's happening now, it has to do with the huge gap between our educated caste, you might say, and a less educated caste. And there's great distrust now between the two groups, and we know all about that.
I have often wondered if you see a role for social media in how we think about information, in fact.
Everything is accessible all the time. And so the incentive to sort of build walls against all of this, or to group yourself among like friends. And I suppose you've seen this on both sides, the willful ignorance of Trump followers who ignore the facts, for instance, that he contradicts himself. But on the other side, you know, the reports that have come out in the past couple of days about the way that the Biden administration kept from the press the health status of President Biden. So, you know, we all have it's always available, that kind of willful ignorance.
Mark, I want to know, though, are there certain types of information that most people do not want to know, and that they are more susceptible to saying, yeah, I'm fine being ignorant about that?
Well, one of those things is our medical condition if we get sick, and certainly also mortality. And so we both want to know and don't want to know what our medical condition is. And in fact, many of the things in life are like that, you know. Now, as I try to point out in the book, the will to know and the will not to know is within all of our heads. And there are often situations where both of them are at play, and understandably.
Mark Lilla is the author of Ignorance and Bliss on Wanting Not to Know. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for the show, Morning Edition, on this Tuesday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Really appreciate you making some time to join us this morning. News from NPR and WPR is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Residential Moving, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. More information, including move estimates, at ReynoldsTransfer.com.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD,